It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The history of its post office is nothing less than the story of America. Of the nation's founding institutions, it is the least appreciated or studied, and yet for a very long time it was the U.S. government's major endeavor. Indeed, it was that government in the experience of most citizens. As radical an experiment as America itself, the Post was the incubator of our uniquely lively, disputatious culture of innovative ideas and uncensored opinions. With astonishing speed, it established the United States as the world's information and communications superpower. Those are the first words of the latest book written by my guest, New York Times bestselling author Winifred Gallagher. How the Post Office Created America is the title of that book. It's a fascinating exploration of the founding, the settling, and the growth of the United States through the lens of the United States Post Office. And Winifred Gallagher joins us for the hour. Welcome to our program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you.
Tell us, let's start from the beginning, because now it's almost worth the chuckle if you say the post office is revolutionary, but it was really at the beginning. Start us after the American Revolution. What was the radical vision that was realized?
Well, yes, the political vision is the place to start. The Patriots, by 1792, the founding fathers, realized that if a government by, for, and of the people was going to work, the people had to know what was going on. They had to know what their elected officials were up to. And in order to be an informed electorate, they had to have access to the latest news and opinions, uncensored opinions, so that they could debate among themselves what the government should do. This was a very ambitious and very radical idea at a time that would have horrified European governments, where basically the authorities told the people what they were allowed to know. So the founders decided to execute their political vision by prioritizing the delivery of newspapers, not letters, but newspapers in their postal scheme of things. So our official communication system was organized around news, not letter mail. This was a very ambitious idea for a country that was still had very little money, was wet behind the ear. George Washington, throughout his two terms, worried about what was going to hold the country together, these 13 very fractious colonies, and they just decided to go all in for a very radical, revolutionary kind of post office, the likes of which the world had never seen.
Winifred, you dedicate this book to Benjamin Franklin, our first postmaster general, and also to a man who does not have the household name quality that Benjamin Franklin has, Dr. Benjamin Rush. Tell us about their roles.
Yes. Well, we're more familiar, of course, with Franklin. He was our nation's first postmaster, as you said, and he was a very good postmaster. But the postal system he ran for America, he had run for some years in Great Britain, and it was pretty much your conventional European postal system that was about delivering for very high prices the business mail of merchants and lawyers and people who had to conduct business over distance via the mail. Benjamin Rush is really, I think, the father of our truly distinctive American post office. He is best known as the Revolutionary War, the Revolutionary Army's doctor. He was not a very good doctor. A lot of his patients died from his draconian treatments, which involved a lot of laxatives and purging and bleeding. Mm. But he was a wonderful political philosopher. He was really an enlightenment figure, and he felt very strongly that the government had to play a strong role in not just informing the people, but educating them. He had come from simple circumstances himself. His dad died when he was very young, and his mom had to send him to a clergyman uncle in order that he be educated. He was educated wonderfully well, and he really felt very strongly that all Americans had to have this access. They had to be literate, and they had to be educated. And he fought very, very hard for he called the post office the true non-electric wire of government. he fought very passionately for the post office, and also for he felt the government should assure public education from kindergarten all the way through college. He's really an unsung hero.
And also, I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more on your mention of Europe. Just after the Revolutionary War, the European postal systems, you point out in your book, were in the control of the monarchs, but also meant to produce money for kings and allow them to spy.
Yes. The postal systems had always been, interestingly, like news of current events itself, a privilege of the elite. So that the, let's say, the British Crown postal system was meant to generate income for the crown. And both France and Britain had very vigorous espionage detection systems where the mail was routinely scrutinized, interrupted and scrutinized. In fact, when the colonists, one of the main reasons why our post office was authorized in 1775, a whole year before the Declaration of Independence, was because the colonists objected to the fact that the Crown postal system, which was operating here in the colonies, was intercepting their mail and delaying their access to newspapers. So, you know, this is kind of, the post office is really in our DNA as a nation. And as you're saying, very much radical in terms of what the rest of the world was up to.
Mm-hmm. In the 1830s, you point out that the French political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville toured the United States. We know his writings from that time, but he was very impressed by the postal system.
He really was. And some of his most interesting comments were, you know, imagine in 1831, we're still, barely an adolescent nation, people pushing westward, living in very rude huts. But even in the Michigan outback, which he visited in a stagecoach that was, of course, carrying the mail, he was thunderstruck by the fact that people could come out of their little log cabins talking about current events, not only in this country, but abroad. He was astonished at the access Americans had to letter mail and newspapers and their political opinions. And this was at a time when, I mean, imagine this, we're still, you know, kind of a wilderness nation. We already had five times more post offices than France and twice as many as Great Britain. It was really an astounding achievement that I think really set us on the road to dominate information and communications globally as we do today.
Mm. You've touched on the politics, how important that was, how revolutionary it was that our founding fathers saw this. But talk a little bit about the economics of it. We have this nation, which 13 colonies on the eastern seaboard, eventually to stretch all the way across North America. How did it grow and shape the young nation over the decades in that way, economically?
It was absolutely vital, and interestingly, was a very unusual and interesting example of government and private industry working together for the good of Americans. First of all, in economic terms, it enabled the national market. It enabled us to grow from an agrarian country to an industrial economy. And even back in the 1820s, the post office was figuring out ways to expedite this transition. They were speeding up business mail wherever they could. Merchants really had no other way to communicate with customers. If you are making widgets in Philadelphia and you want to sell them to somebody in Boston, you had to do that through the post office. And our postal executives were very quick to seize upon the importance of that shift and expedite it.
Mm-hmm.
A little later in the Civil War, very important advance, money orders. Postal money orders were invented so that Union soldiers could send their salaries back home safely. I mean, imagine until the 1860s, if people wanted to get money from point A to point B without carrying it physically themselves, they had to put it in the mail. So suddenly in the Civil War, Americans could go to the post office and send a safe money order. And it caught on very rapidly with the public. It was no longer just the army using it. It was a huge boon to the business world. And then at the turn of the 20th century, the post office started postal savings banking, which went into the 1960s, which people talk about reviving today, because then, as now, a lot of Americans, up to 20%, 25% of Americans, are underserved by the banking industry. The banking industry sees that they can't really make any money on lower-income people, people in rural areas, and they just, redline them from banking services. But the post office provided those services for a lot of rural people, small-town people who had a safe place to keep their money, who could make a modest amount of interest. It was really took off during the Depression, of course, because it had the full backing of the United States government at a time when a lot of banks were crashing.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, it also was an enormous spur. I mean, imagine if you have ideas about being a newspaper publisher or a magazine publisher, if you know that the post office is going to deliver your product almost for free, for a penny, this is an enormous spur to the publishing and the advertising industries. And I guess lastly, in economic terms, it was a major shaper of our modern consumer culture with parcel post. This is, again, back at the turn of the 20th century. Rural Americans, still 60% of Americans then, they were pretty much stuck with buying and paying for whatever the merchants at their general store wanted to charge for a very limited arrangement of goods. They were really, really very deprived in that regard at a time that the Montgomery Ward catalog and the Sears catalog were taking off. The reason that they couldn't take advantage of those catalogs is because the delivery of parcels was monopolized by private carriers who charged exorbitant rates. This is Wells Fargo and American Express. And the post office came in and with postal parcel service, cut those rates so that rural Americans could really join the consumer culture at fair prices. It was a huge, huge boom to them. And of course, the post office has always been and still is one of the nation's major civilian employers. It's still number two, only behind Walmart. So it's an enormous boon to the economy.
If you just joined us, my guest this hour is New York Times bestselling author Winifred Gallagher. How the Post Office Created America is her new book. She's exploring in the book the founding and settling and the growth of the United States through the lens of the post office. I was interested, Winifred, to see, you spoke of the Civil War, the tie-in between the Civil War and home delivery of mail.
Yes. We had a really exceptional postmaster general appointed by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, Montgomery Blair. He was kind of an American aristocrat, a very fancy family. In fact, their Washington, D.C. residence is Blair House, which is where visiting heads of state stay when they're here to visit the president. And he had the vision to use the crisis of the Civil War to enact these amazing expansions of postal service, one of which you just brought up, which was done on compassionate grounds as well. During the Civil War, some 600,000 men were killed, many more wounded. People wanting to know what was happening with their loved ones had to literally go to the post office and wait in long lines and perhaps receive a letter saying their loved one had died. So that there were terrible scenes of grief going on at post offices. And a postal worker in Ohio named Joseph Briggs was so moved by this that he volunteered to deliver the mail during the war to people's homes, so at least they could have privacy if they were going to get a bad news. And the idea was so so obviously a good idea that the Postmaster General Blair, who had wanted to do this anyway, was able to use the war as an excuse to do this great service, city-free delivery. So Americans who lived in cities and towns, spread to smaller and smaller increments, were able to have their mail delivered at home. It was a big expense. You had to hire a whole new postal workforce of mailmen to do it. But he was able to rationalize it partly because in the Civil War, the Confederates appropriated one third of the postal system, which saved the Union postal system a lot of money. And they were able to use that money to start new services like money orders and free city delivery.
Mm-hmm. Is this also when postal addresses, street addresses and zip codes started to become a thing?
Well, not quite zip codes. We have to wait a while for that one. But yes, the decision to do first city free delivery and then the turn of the 20th century rural free delivery meant that a lot of Americans got their first addresses. And a lot of towns and cities got their first street signs. It was an amazing construction of the American's physical landscape into a social landscape as well, which is something we should have touched on a little bit when we were talking about the politics of the mm-hmm. post office. Once the founders decided to create this this ambitious system, in order to do that, how are you going to get the newspapers and letters to the people in this wilderness? So they had to essentially create a landscape that consisted of towns and villages centered on the post office, which was often the only address for that whole community, and then connecting those post offices with post roads one to another so that the mail could be circulated. So in many senses, when you're looking at maps of the early United States, you're really looking at postal maps. It was enormous importance in that regard. And it also imposed the federal footprint on huge contested areas of land. Remember, early on, France, Spain, Great Britain, Russia all had claims to the continent. So one way to literally and figuratively plant the American flag was to establish a post office.
Mm-hmm. You also point out on your book how important these post offices were, and I'm sure many of our listeners, not so much anymore, but in earlier generations, used the post office in especially small towns as a social hub to find out what's going on in town.
Absolutely, and not by accident, a lot of the early post offices were not standalone buildings as we have today. They were located in businesses, and they were often located in taverns and inns where people would go in, have a glass of ale, sit down. They were expected to share their mail with their friends, read letters aloud, pass newspapers around. It was very, very much a social center. And in fact, here in my town in northwestern Wyoming, the post office is still the town social center. It's most people could have their mail delivered to their home mailboxes, but they prefer to go to the post office because it's a small town and it's a place where you can socialize and see your friends and figure out what's going on. It's still very popular. The post office is one of the reasons why it's so hard to make blanket statements about is it has to be many things for many people.
Mm-hmm.
It means something different to rural and urban people, to the young and old, to the rich and poor. And also think of the incredible geographic span of this country. So the post office has to serve, you know, Key West, Florida, and Nome, Alaska. It still delivers mail to the bottom of Grand Canyon by donkey. So it has to wear a lot of hats, our post office.
In researching over 200 years of post office history, I wonder if you considered the idea, considering the radical beginnings, the departure from European mail systems, if we had not had this vision, if this had not happened this way, we could have been a radically different country, or it just wouldn't have worked.
Absolutely. In fact, there were some people among the people.
We're having a little trouble. There, you're back. Okay, Winifred, we had a little drop out there. Go ahead, please.
Alexander Hamilton was among the founding fathers who was not sure that we should go this route favored by Jefferson and Madison and Rush. He was leaning towards the kind of post office that Franklin ran and that the British ran, where it should make money for the federal government. So there was a real argument about whether we should do this, but the forces for informing the entire population proved victorious.
Mm-hmm. Also here at the forefront of giving women jobs in the public sector.
Absolutely. One of the most important functions of of the post office as a social force in the country's development. It was the first major employer of women and minorities, especially African Americans, people who were disenfranchised. Remember, women couldn't vote until 1919. But we had Mary Catherine Goddard, the first female postmaster in her own right, was way back in the 1770s. So I'm not trying to suggest that it was easy for women to get these good federal jobs. Being a postmaster was considered a good job and a status job. They had to fight their way through the system, but they were able to become usually rural postmasters, especially once the West started developing, because there simply weren't enough men to do all the jobs, so they had to give the women a chance. They were often very competent, really interesting figures. And then, of course, after the Civil War, African Americans in slavery times had been forbidden in the early 1800s from even carrying the mail. So a master on a plantation, he was not going to let his enslaved person carry the mail, because the fear was that the educated enslaved people would read in newspapers that all men were created equal, that they would read about the slave rebellion in Haiti. So African-Americans were really prohibited from contact with the mail until the Civil War. And then they rapidly entered the force, both as postal executives, postmasters, postal administrators in Washington, and letter carriers.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute before a break, but really interesting. You have so many interesting names, figures that we don't recognize many of the names, at least I don't, like Benjamin Franklin, of course, we recognize, but many of them, not Mary Fields, is an African-American woman who played an interesting role in the stagecoach phase of delivery of the mail. But I think we're going to have to wait until we come back for that story. Winifred Gallagher is with us. How the Post Office Created America, a fascinating look at exactly what it says. How the Post Office Created America. We'll come back. We'll hear about the stagecoach, also the Pony Express, the trains being places for mail to be sorted, all kinds of things yet to come as we move into the 19th and 20th century, tracing the mail. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with New York Times bestselling author Winifred Gallagher. How the Post Office Created America is her latest book. She looks at the founding, the settling, the growth of the United States, the important role that the U.S. Post Office played in this. Fascinating things. You might not think that this is a fascinating history, but it is very different than the way we think of the post office today. And we'll get to the post office's crisis today in the digital age a little bit later in the program, but talking about how the mail was delivered across this vast land, and tell us about the Pony Express. How did that get started, Winifred, and its role in the mail? And you point out in your book that it had a part in keeping California from becoming a slave state.
Yes, the Pony Express, which most people very strongly with the post office, was actually never a part of the post office. It was a private business, and it was meant actually as almost a publicity stunt to snag the big federal Western stagecoach mail contract from a competitor. So the Pony Express lasted only 18 months, but it really was truly astounding. It took at least 25 days to move the mail from Missouri, where the railroad ended, to California by stagecoach. And the Pony Express was able to do that with these really fearless young men in just 10 days. So it seemed like almost like email back then.
Did your letter have a 100% chance of arriving? I suppose not.
No, they actually had a very high success rate. I think there was only one instance where a mailbag was intercepted by angry Native Americans. But I believe that the mailbag was actually found later in the letters delivered. The reason they were so successful and they were pursued by hostile bandits and Indian people, they just went so fast. They could outrun the Indian ponies, which were grass-fed. Their own horses were grain-fed. And they just shot through the West like bolts of lightning. They were really very interesting.
So in that sense, the Hollywood vision of the Pony Express is more or less accurate.
Yeah, I mean they did heroic stuff, especially over the big Western mountains in all weathers. I mean, to go over the Rocky Mountains in the wintertime on a horse at breakneck speed is really an accomplishment. Interestingly, the Pony Express, I think, changed the way Americans thought about themselves and about their Midwest and Western regions, which were, you know, still being developed, and the way America was seen around the world as this kind of can-do, enterprising, swashbuckling, young Western-oriented country. I think it was important in that regard that these Midwesterners were capable of doing almost anything in very difficult circumstances. And as you pointed out, the pony also played an important role in connecting California to the Union. It was very much up in the air whether California, with all its fabulous riches and gold, whether that was going to go to the Confederacy or the Union. And think about how far away they were from other Union states. They were actually closer to Texas. So one of the major things that the Pony Express did, even though it was just one incident, it raced President Lincoln's inaugural speech across the country very fast. So the Californians were heartened by his vision of national unity, and that's acknowledged as helping to keep the Union in California in the Union.
Winifred Gallagher is with me. How the Post Office Created America is her book. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question about the Post Office now or throughout its long history, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tell us about Mary Fields. I mentioned her last hour. This is the stagecoach era, and she is an African-American at work on a stagecoach.
Yes, she's a wonderful figure. Stagecoach Mary Fields was born enslaved in the South, and after the war, she was more or less adopted by a group of nuns who loved her and brought her with them to open a school in Montana, in the wilds of Montana. This was, you know, after the war, really the Wild West, the way we think of it in the movies and so forth. Mary was a very interesting character. She was 6 feet tall, strong as a man. She was a crack shot. She liked to visit the bar. she was a very colorful character. She liked to buy candy for children. But she also got into a number of fights, and the local bishop got cross with Mary, and the nuns bought her a wagon and set her up as a postal contractor so that she delivered the mail by wagon in Montana in the late 19th century. And when she died, she actually got big obituaries in both of the local larger papers. Mm-hmm. So she was a very celebrated figure. She actually brings up something very important that I want to stress too. The post office, to a degree that most of us have no appreciation for, subsidized the nation's transportation grid all the way from the days of the stagecoach through the airlines. America back when, you know, in 1792, and stagecoach was the state-of-the-art way to get around, these little companies were struggling. How were they going to provide Americans with transportation and make a go of it? They really couldn't have done it without the stage, without the post office subsidizing them to carry the mail. So very soon there were quite elaborate networks of stagecoach routes so that Americans could and did travel surprising distances. And, you know, a good part of the cost of that was paid for by the post office. In fact, people loved to travel on what was called the mail coach because that was the fast coach. This goes all the way through the railroad, which the post subsidized, although the railroad was not as dependent upon the post office as the stagecoaches had been. But the really stirring story, I think, is aviation. The post office for many, many years kind of single-handedly supported the whole aviation industry. We have to recall that when the Wright brothers flew in Kitty Hawk in 1903 or 1904, there was really no practical utility for the airplane. No one knew what to do with it. I mean, it was cool, and you could go to like a county fair and see somebody, a pilot, drive around in the sky and ooh and ah, but no one could figure out what to do with it. There were no airports. There were no runways. There were no aviation companies. There were no navigation aids. It was really not until World War I that people began to see something of a use of the planes for military purposes. But after the war, again, people were saying, well, what are we going to do with these flying machines? And the market was flooded with these little Jenny airplanes that the post office adopted. The post office was undeterred in 1918, actually started airmail, using these little Jenny airplanes that were incredibly flimsy contraptions made of wood and canvas, and they started flying the mail. And the adventures of these early pilots who had to land in cow pastures and often were in just absolutely hair-raising circumstances, it's a lot of fun to read about these guys.
And Charles Lindbergh, really like, Charles Lindbergh was one of them.
When Charles Lindbergh was in France after his historic flight across the Atlantic, he was asked what his future plans were. And he said, I am an airmail pilot, and I expect to fly the mail again. They were really the cowboys of the air. They were very interesting. And they, as I say, they supported that industry with their subsidizations. Until really the 1940s, until the airline companies were able to support themselves on passenger services.
How the Post Office Created America is the title of Winifred Gallagher's new book, and we're talking about it this hour with her. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We have about 10 minutes left. Winifred, so many notes I have here we're not going to be able to get through. We have to move into the more modern era to talk about the problems of the Postal Service today. Describe the Post Office's current crisis. What are the major reasons behind it?
Well, if we could back up a little bit, the crisis really has long-term roots. Back in the early part of the 20th century, the two world wars and the Depression essentially deprived the Post Office of money, but there simply weren't the resources with these emergencies going on to get to the post office. So their technology fell farther and farther behind, even as Americans' mail volume was doubling. So they had more and more work to do with fewer and fewer resources. That really caught up with them. Some of your older listeners will remember in the 1960s and 70s, when some of the big urban post offices that were really very poorly equipped to handle these enormous volumes of mail simply ground to a halt. Chicago in 1966 is the most famous. They basically just shut down for several weeks. They just couldn't deliver the mail anymore. So this led to President Nixon in 1970 changing the post office into what was supposed to be a kind of unusual government business hybrid. It was supposed to work more like a business. It was, the name was changed from the Post Office Department to the United States Postal Service. But unlike a business, they were subjected to congressional interference and a lot of it. And they were also told that they had to keep their prices low despite their costs. And on the same hand, they received no tax dollars. So many people argue that they received that it was the worst of both worlds, the government interference plus the business's lack of outside support. So they were really in a pickle. In the short term, one of the big issues, of course, is that back in the 1980s, the post office could have gone digital. There were visionary people both in postal management and in Congress who said, look, email is the logical extension of paper mail. We need to do this. But unfortunately, both Congress and the postal managers were so traumatized by the big meltdowns, they were afraid to make that big step. They were afraid to make that big adjustment to the digital revolution. They did greatly improve the automation of paper mail, but they missed that logical next step. So nonetheless, the post office was pretty much paying its own way until 2007, when, of course, the big recession hit. But more importantly, Congress passed a disastrous piece of legislation called the Postal Accountability and Enforcement Act of 2006. That's what really started the acute crisis. When you hear today about the postal deficit, a huge lion's share of that is that the post office was ordered to pre-fund its retiree health care benefits to the tune of $5 billion a year for 10 years. This was a draconian demand that no institution, public or private, had ever been forced to do. And that really put them in, you know, headed to bankruptcy.
Was that passed on a bipartisan basis?
It was, in 2006. There's a lot of agitation now to do something about that. But, you know, for the past 10 years, the post office has been laboring under that law. With this huge burden to give the Treasury $5 billion a year for 10 years. And at the same time, that law also restricted what they were allowed to do in terms of innovative services. Post office can't decide that they want to, deliver wine in the mail or install a bank of computers in your local community post office. They have to get permission from Congress to do that. And there are a lot of very powerful lobbies that pay for political campaigns that are very invested in the postal status quo. And that's one reason why reform has been so slow in coming. For example, the big postal unions don't want to stop Saturday mail delivery, even though Americans for 50 years have said they could do without Saturday letter mail delivery. It would mean loss of their members' jobs and hours. And the big junk mailers don't want to get rid of Saturday delivery because they like to send their circulars for weekend shoppers. They like that weekend exposure.
Right.
So this is the kind of lobbying that goes on that delays progress in reforming the post office.
We have about 5 minutes left with Winifred Gallagher, How the Post Office Created America is her book. Having done the research and the writing, the colorful stories, the development, understanding how it fits with the creation of the United States, the post office right alongside it. What do you see now and into the future? Will we have a post office in a generation or two?
Oh, certainly. The post office delivers 40% of the entire world's mail. It's a huge organization that neither the private services of FedEx and UPS could. They would risk bankruptcy trying to deliver America's mail. I don't think privatization is going to come down. It's not widely popular with most Americans. They don't see why they should have to choose between paper mail and email. The post office doesn't get any of their tax dollars. And actually, what a lot of people don't realize is that the two private carriers and the post office are not so much competitors anymore as co-competitors. They cooperate in delivering America's mail. The post office goes to every address in America almost daily, which neither of the other carriers could do. And it pays the post office to do a lot of their deliveries for them. And the post office pays FedEx to fly U.S. mail on FedEx planes. So I don't think privatization is going to happen. Mm-hmm. The other extreme, we could try to refit postal service for the digital age and give us all government digital addresses the same way the government gave us our physical addresses. The post office could provide more services, verification and authentication for legal and business transactions, postal banking. This would be, I think, politically a hard sell in a center-right country because it would require a big infusion investment in an infrastructure. So I think the likeliest one is that the post office will pare back to a delivery system that will continue to be the national hard copy delivery system and will support itself on profitable services, which right now there's a tremendous boom in delivering parcels. Post office revenue from parcels rose by 50% just between 2010 and 2015. So that's really making up for the loss of first class mail to email. And I think the system is going to go in that direction.
Okay, let's squeeze in at least one call this hour. Austin is with us from Des Moines. Have to ask you to be brief. Austin, what's your question?
Thank you. My question has to do with the logistics of elections in a time that predated the internet and even widespread electricity usage. What role did the post office play in communicating nationwide election results, and what did that process kind of look like?
Thank you, Austin. What about that, Winifred? Is that something you looked into?
I think that the major way would have been through delivering news. Certainly the post office today delivers registration materials. And here's actually something that the caller is reminding me of that's very important. In the 2014 elections, 20% of the national elections, 20% of the ballots were cast by mail. The big Western states are really behind this idea. It's much more efficient. It costs much less to do voting by mail. And I can see that really taking off for the same reasons. The states want to save money. So that's another reason why we want to have a safe, secure postal system if we're going to be voting by mail. And our postal system is admired all over the world for its security and privacy.
We have just a minute or so left. I want to mention some of the interesting trivia you have in your book as well. Talk about ballots being sent through the mail. You write that the Hope Diamond, is this the world's largest diamond, was sent through the U.S. Postal Service for just a few dollars?
Yes. Harry Winston, the famous New York jeweler, wanted to give the Hope Diamond to the nation, to the Smithsonian Institution, and he mailed it for $2.41.
What year?
That shows the I want to say like 1960s, early 60s.
Right?
That shows the faith that people have in the safety and security of the post office.
Mm-hmm. America's most famous stamp, mentioned in your book as well, called the Inverted Jenny. Quickly, the story behind that.
Yes. The Jenny was the airplane that we talked about a little while ago that was the first airmail-used plane, very colorful little airplane. And an issue of stamps of Jennies, it had both the colors of red and blue, and somebody taking the row of stamps off the press and put it in upside down so that there was a sheet of Jennies that looked like the plane is flying upside down the way it might happen at an air show. Very valuable stamps.
Do you have any idea what an inverted Jenny, the most valuable stamp of America's stamps, what that might be worth today?
I think at least $500,000, I would think, for a Jenny.
Okay. We'll be on the lookout for those. Go up into your attic and look for old mail,
yes,
I guess.
Yes. Definitely.
We've run out of time. Thank you very much. Winifred Gallagher, her latest book, How the Post Office Created America. Winifred, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It was my pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon with help from Graham Bly. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. I wish I had a lot of energy.
answers. That's the way it should be. But all these questions be directed at me. I just can't.